Welcome back to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone, and today on this episode, we are talking about music for health. We are exploring the health properties and the therapeutic qualities of music. We've seen how this idea goes all the way back into biblical times with the account of the young harpist David soothing King Saul, making him well, it says in the scripture. We talked about how this idea was prevalent among the Pythagoreans, how it's been referenced in great literature, and how it was even used in World War II to disarm a German sniper. We've been talking about the standard repertoire or the standard music history, starting with the Baroque era, which had a variant of this idea. It was embodied in this doctrine of affections, where they felt that music was to impact the fluids inside the human body and therefore to help the emotions. So this idea meant that Baroque music was intended to be extremely emotional and moving and health-building. In the classical era, a composer came along, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, who would be studied years later for the therapeutic qualities of his music and how it aided in the health of epileptics. And then we talked about the Romantic era, the most common usage of music intended to calm or soothe is that of the lullaby. And we talked about Johannes Brahms from the Romantic era, a great composer of that time period, and his most famous piece by far that's been arranged and adapted, and so many different renditions have been performed of his lullaby. Now, we're going to stay in the Romantic era and talk about a Romantic era composer from Russia. He lived into the 20th century. Even into the 20th century, he was still writing in the Romantic era style. His name was Sergei Rachmaninoff. And thinking about music for health, he comes to mind because one of his greatest compositions was the result of a rehabilitation of sorts. This wasn't a case of actual music therapy, but it was a case where great music was the result of his rehabilitation, and it became one of his most well-known works. What happened before this great piece of music was composed was this. Rachmaninoff had just premiered his first symphony, and this occurred in St. Petersburg in March of 1897. The performance did not go well, some say due to the orchestra being under-rehearsed and poorly conducted. Added to that, it was panned by composer César Cui, who was one of Russia's Mighty Five, a group of composers who championed Russian music. Cui likened this symphony to a student composer from a music school in the underworld writing a symphony about the 10 plagues of Egypt. Ugh. Well, after Rachmaninoff's death, it was performed again, and this time very well received. Nonetheless, this less-than-triumphant premiere and this extremely harsh criticism threw Rachmaninoff into a state of great depression for about 3 years, during which time this great composer wrote almost nothing. With the help of a Dr. Nikolai Dahl, after about 4 months of psychological therapy, which essentially was just positive thinking and overcoming his doubt and skepticism in his own abilities, Rachmaninoff began writing a piano concerto that now stands as one of his most famous works. It was thankfully well received at its premiere in 1901, and the composer dedicated it to Dr. Dahl. I want to play you a little bit of the first two movements, and then play you the third movement in its entirety. The first movement is very intense with these rich melodies that are just dripping with Russian nationalism. Here's a little bit of the first movement. The second movement of Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 2 is pure genius in how he takes a rhythmic element in the piano, completely sets up our expectation to follow this rhythmic element, and yet we find out when the melody comes in that the way we've been hearing this rhythmic element is all wrong. When the piano comes in at the beginning of the second movement, it sounds like the way the notes are organized, they are in four-note groups. And then, when the flute comes in with the main melody, it sounds like the flute is hitting in the wrong area until you realize that the piano hasn't been playing four-note groups of notes this entire time, but three-note groups, triplets. And so it's this paradox of these four-note groupings on top of this melody that fits obviously into a triplet style. And even if you don't know the particular technicalities of that, I think you can still appreciate that when you hear the flute come in and how unexpected this rhythm is. Thank you. finally, let's listen to a complete movement of this piano concerto by Rachmaninoff. I want to play you the third movement. It is a very exciting movement. It's the final movement. It contains the most famous melody probably that Rachmaninoff wrote. It was turned into a Frank Sinatra song, Full Moon and Empty Arms. So here is this third movement of Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 2, performed by pianist Stephen Huff and the Dallas Symphony Orchestra.
Thank you.
We are talking about the health properties and the therapeutic qualities of music today on Music for Life. This is Music for Health. Rachmaninoff's Second Piano Concerto is an example of music that was written after some great rehabilitation. You could say it was a sign of good mental health. The composer had just recovered from a 3-year depression after a disastrous premiere of one of his works, and the subsequent criticism caused him to doubt his abilities as a composer. But thankfully, he came out of that and wrote this wonderful work that was the third and final movement of his Piano Concerto No. 2, performed by the Dallas Symphony Orchestra with conductor Andrew Litton and pianist Stephen Huff. Now it's time for our Classroom Corner segment, where we explore different methods and curricula for introducing young people to music.
To take each moment and live each moment in peace eternally.
All music educators who teach in a classroom setting use the component of ensemble singing as part of their methods. Even though this has great value in teaching musical concepts, it also has a powerful component as relates to health. There are many health benefits to singing as part of a group. Studies have shown that group singing, even more than just solo singing, has a stress-relieving, calming, and yet energizing effect on the singer. The elation of singing in a choir or singing as a class may come from the release of endorphins, oxytocin, and the neurotransmitter dopamine. Endorphins are hormones associated with feelings of pleasure, and oxytocin has been found to alleviate anxiety and stress. Singing in groups is particularly bonding, as oxytocin is known to enhance feelings of unity and coherence. Additionally, dopamine is associated with feelings of pleasure and alertness. Studies have shown that feelings of depression and loneliness lessen when this hormone is released. One study found that singers tend to have lower levels of cortisol, a hormone which is present in higher quantities when one has high stress levels. Another study conducted by researchers at a university in Sweden concluded that the heart rates of choir members became synchronized as they sang in unison. The results of the study were published in Frontiers in Neuroscience, and it supports the idea that singing in group settings has a calming, unifying effect. Pulse monitors were attached to the singers' ears, and researchers found that as the choir sang, their heart rate slowed. This is because as the singers exhaled, their heart rates would slow down, as noted by musicologist Bjorn Wyckoff, leader of the research project. He was surprised at how quickly the singers' heart rates became synchronized. So, to keep our children healthy, we might tell them to get some fresh air, to get some sleep, or to eat their vegetables. Here's one more thing we can add to the list of activities that contribute to good health: singing in choirs, music classes, or other groups. In addition to its educational musical value, a chorus a day might just keep the doctor away. This has been Classroom Corner. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Now we will move into our segment, Backstage Banter, where we interview performers on the concert circuit today for their perspectives on music. Now, today's interview is not with someone constantly performing music on the concert stage. She is performing music in a unique environment and for an audience that is commonly performing along with her. Her name is Amber Loomis, and she is a music therapist. She has a private practice at the Zeta Music Therapy Clinic in Norman, Oklahoma, and she is also on staff at a hospital in Oklahoma City.
My name is Amber Loomis, and I am MME-MTBC. So that's, I have my master's in music education with emphasis in music therapy, and then our credential for music therapist is music therapist board certified once you pass the board exam.
And could you talk a bit about the musical background you have before we get into the music therapy portion of it? As a musician, what's your background in the field?
Well, I originally started in about kindergarten doing a program called the Yamaha Music Program. So it was a lot of keyboard and just general music, singing and rhythm. And my dad's a pianist, so he started my brothers and sisters and I all with that program. And then I started playing violin, started with Suzuki training in violin, and then also was involved in a lot of choirs growing up all through high school. So music has always been a big part of my life. So I did my undergrad at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, in music education. And about my junior year there, I started hearing about music therapy, and I researched a little bit, and I just loved music therapy. I loved music education, but music therapy was kind of exactly what I was wanting to do through music education. I felt like I could have more of a direct impact on the clients that I was working with. So I decided to switch gears a little bit and pursue my master's in music therapy. And actually, really, there's a lot of transfer with that because I do a lot of similar things, but the difference is with music education, your goals are all music-driven for music outcomes. And for music therapy, the music outcomes aren't as important, but you're focusing more on non-music goals, such as maybe a physical goal or a social goal. Or I've done a lot of academic goals, working with kids on different, if they're behind in some of their academics, trying to make it a way that's a little more fun and easier for them to remember.
What in general does a music therapist do?
The field of music therapy is pretty broad. Right now I work primarily with behavioral health. So I work with a lot of emotional and behavioral disorders and developmental disorders. But there's music therapists that can work in all different areas in hospitals, more of the rehab type setting to work on more physical goals, also geriatrics and Alzheimer's. There's a lot of research with Alzheimer's. But it's amazing how there's individuals that can't remember their significant other, their name, but then you start singing a song and they can remember all the words to the song. So it helps tack into their memory. There's also a lot of music therapists that work in rehab centers to try to help deal with individuals that are trying to overcome maybe substance abuse. So there's, you know, kind of a huge wide range of different areas. Some music therapists that are employed by facilities, other music therapists do private practice contract work. And some facilities will start hiring music therapists if they're interested in it as a contract, as sort of a trial basis. A lot of school districts will do that. If they have a couple kids, they want music therapy. Maybe not necessarily a full-time position yet. So they'll contract out maybe for a couple hours a week. So a lot of my colleagues that I went to school with, sort of what they're doing right now is they'll work in all these different areas and kind of find contracts here and there and kind of piece together this sort of business for themselves. Mm-hmm. And more we're starting to see facilities where they will hire music therapists actually employed for the facility and more part-time positions opening up. But right now, I think as a field, the big focus is really advocating to get more positions and get more facilities to offer these services. I work about 4 days a week at St. Anthony, but I've also been really trying to promote and advocate through music therapy, through Zeta Music Therapy. We have a private practice, and we've been trying to do a lot of different presentations. We've been to different support groups and trying to talk to different people and educate them about music therapy and start building a client base and let people know that what music therapy is and what we do. So it's always great to have an opportunity to share what we do with others.
And that's Zeta Music Therapy Clinic in Norman, Oklahoma.
Based in Norman, yep.
What are some misnomers about music therapy or things that you'd want to educate the general public about this profession in general?
The title is a little bit misleading at times where they think that we're working, you know, primarily with musicians, when in reality it's the other way around. Anyone, I think, can benefit from music therapy. The biggest misnomer that I often get is that when I'm at work, sometimes people will see me with all instruments and all different things and be like, oh, you're the music lady, you're playing music for us, which is true, we do that, but many people see it as entertainment. But what we do as music therapists is evidence-based practice. So we have research backing up everything that we do, and it's, you know, we're taking data and it's a very documented process. And there's a lot of science behind it as well. And I think a lot of people don't necessarily know that side of the profession. I think that's one of the reasons that a lot of facilities are a little bit hesitant to hire music therapists, is because they're not aware of all the science and all the background that is part of our profession.
What's some of the science behind this profession?
I brought with me our national organization, the American Music Therapy Association, has some great resources if you're interested in looking at some of the specific studies. But just to summarize a few of the different benefits that the research that we've had has been shown. For example, for pain management, music therapy has been found to help reduce pain. And there's a whole bunch of physical benefits as well. It's been found to improve respiration, lower blood pressure, improve cardiac output, reduce heart rate, and reduce muscle tension. It's been found to direct attention away from pain and anxiety, provide visual imagery, and condition a relaxation response. And it's been found to change mood and focus on positive thoughts and feelings. In mental health, music therapy has been found to improve social interactions, improve concentration and attention span, adopt positive behavior, and it's been found to assist in resolving conflicts and lead to a stronger family and peer relationships. So in each of these different areas, there's all sorts of research. And like I said, the American Music Therapy Association does a really nice job of kind of summarizing all those. And then with older adults, it's found to reduce depression, enhance social emotional skills, assess cognitive ability. It's found to decrease agitated and aggressive behaviors for individuals diagnosed with Alzheimer's. The individuals in late stages of dementia that might not respond to other stimuli will respond and interact with music, which I think is pretty amazing. And one of the reasons that is because it's one of the few things that we do that uses the entire area of our brain. So if there are certain areas that might be damaged due to disease or traumatic brain injury, we can use music to sort of access other areas and reroute and sort of try to get to some of those same thoughts and feelings that we didn't necessarily have access to without that.
Reminds me of Dr. Oliver Sacks' Musicophilia book. Uh-huh. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
But that is actually reading that book, one of my friends suggested that I read it, and that was where I first sort of heard about music therapy. So I love that. It's great. Great book. So those are just a few. And then there's been a lot of research too with autism and individuals with special needs, and working on showing increased attention, decreased self-stimulation, improved cognitive functioning, increased socialization, improved behaviors, enhanced auditory processing, and enhanced sensory motor skills. So I could just go on and on and on and talk about all the benefits. It's really quite amazing what music therapy can do.
That's awesome. So, well, walk us through your clinic or your workspace and what give us a virtual tour of what's all there and what you're doing with these patients.
Well, I currently right now work 32 hours a week at St. Anthony Hospital, and I'm on a child psychiatric unit there. I'm part of a team that they call the Therapeutic Activity Services. And our services are put directly on the treatment plan as soon as the kids are admitted. So, I mean, that's great because I get the opportunity to see many different patients. With kids, changing it up is the best. So I try to have lots of different things and bring in new things every day. So I do a lot of drumming. I use a lot of drums. I'll do drum circles and kind of work on following the leader and let different kids lead the group. I also use a lot of shaker eggs and bells and rhythm sticks and different instruments, because the kids that I see all come from different music backgrounds. So that way you might have one child that has taken music lessons before or has a very strong background, and other children that have no experience. So I try to use a lot of instruments that kind of equalize that, but still create an environment that everyone is able to be successful but not be bored, so try to sort of even things out. I use a lot of guitar with the kids so that I can be mobile and be walking around, and kind of helps control the behaviors, I think, when you're able to be closer to the kids. I also like to do a lot of folk-type songs, too, because I think they're, especially if you're trying to engage in singing, they're very singable, things that have very catchy tunes. I love when people leave humming a song all day.
Or some of the folk songs that you use.
One of my favorite songs, and it's great because I've used it with kids, adults, all sorts of settings. There's a song by the Carpenters called "The Sunny Side of Life." It's probably one of my favorites because it just has such a beautiful message. They come from all different backgrounds. Some of them have been in and out of different foster homes and DHS custody, so they haven't had family singing those songs to them. So even some of the simple songs like "You Are My Sunshine" will do beautiful. I also have Boomwhackers. I didn't think I mentioned that earlier, and that's always a hit with the kids as well. We'll do different arrangements and have them play different notes, and I might let them pick what instruments they want to play where. So, and they've come up with just some beautiful arrangements of some of these songs. I also have tried to do some different electronics. I have an omnichord. The kids love the omnichord, so I'll bring that out and let them look at that and kind of choose different whatever rhythms and whatever instruments that they want, because it's a great way for them to be able to have some control and have some choice, because when you're in the hospital setting, and many of these kids are there for months at a time, they don't get a lot of that. So giving them the opportunity to choose what instruments they want and what type of rhythms or what songs they want to do is a great way to give them back a little bit of control.
Mm-hmm. And so a lot of that is activity participation based. How much, or is there any part of your day that's listening based, using mm-hmm. music as a, you know, listening to it, and what are the therapeutic elements in that?
Every group that I see the kids, I'll have at least a few minutes where we do some sort of listening. A lot of that depends on the kids I have at the time, or maybe the piece of music that I want to expose them to. If it's something that I think is able to be conveyed best by actually listening to the recording, I'll bring that in depending on, you know, if it's a song the kids are really familiar with, sometimes that's going to attract their attention and be more effective than me playing it for them. So sometimes I'll have them listen to the recording and then I'll play it as we're learning the song. Also, I'll do a lot of lyric analysis. And so for that, I'll play a lot of music for the kids so that way they can follow along with the words and have more of an opportunity to be able to focus on the lyrics and the words and what sticks out to them. And then also I'll use recorded music for relaxation at times, because I found that that can be very effective, and that way I can be free to help assist the kids and give them some cues and some auditory cues to be able to focus on different areas of their body. And it's can be very effective, I've found, to sort of decrease if we'll have a crisis going on the unit or some kids are acting up, can be helped to kind of reduce stimuli in that way. In other settings, when I've worked more one-on-one with patients, depending on what their goals are, I will use more recorded music, or if they have maybe a certain artist that I can't portray the music the same way they can, and I'll incorporate it some that way. So I would say I probably do 75% more live and then maybe 25% recorded music.
You've mentioned that a lot of your efforts are at pain control mm-hmm. and that type of thing. How much are they aimed at rehabilitation of some ailment or after some trauma?
There are a lot of music therapists. I know there's a few music therapists at Integris, at Jim Thorpe, that work in the rehab setting. My experience primarily is with behavioral health, but I also am part of a private practice where we're building up clients and trying to do a lot of advocacy, and get, as I mentioned earlier, because I think that's one of the biggest things our field needs right now is just the education so that people know what we do and that we're available to provide these services. So we've been putting on a lot of workshops and presentations, and one of our my partners has actually a lot of experience in working with rehab and individuals with traumatic brain injury. There's a lot of, you know, research. Music therapy is great for working on gait and improving gait. So the benefits for in a rehab setting are great. I think more hospitals could benefit from, there's a lot of hospitals that are starting to hire music therapists, but not necessarily all their patients get a chance to see them. And it, you know, depending on what the time constraints, a lot of times it goes in order of who might best fit the criteria, where in reality there's many people that could benefit from those services.
And you work in a hospital, as you said, and so doctors are prescribing music therapy for particular patients. What are those general symptoms you could say that they're prescribing you for?
There are doctors that will prescribe music therapy if they're not if they're having difficulty making progress on their goals, sort of trying a different method. If they know that particular patient has some experience with music and they think that would assist them and connect them.
And what conditions would you as a music therapist like to see make more inroads in the medical field where doctors are prescribing music therapy in addition to those conditions you just described? What else would you like to see music therapy being used for?
I think music therapy has, as you know, I went through all these different benefits that research has shown. We have the research to show that music therapy can be used in all these different areas and for all these different goals. And I think in different places, there's music therapists doing all these things. But I think our goal now is to just expand on more of what we're doing. Because I think we have this research showing that music can help decrease pain. But if you go to a lot of hospitals, they don't necessarily have music therapists doing so. Other areas that I think, I know, in my setting with behavioral health, I see a lot of groups because that's sort of what insurance mandates and the kids have to have so many groups. I would love the opportunity to be able to do more one-on-one with them. When I was interning at Lawrence Public Schools, I had a lot of kids. It was in an inpatient setting, but they had similar behavioral goals and social goals. And I had the opportunity to see them one-on-one. And I think it allows you to be able to process more. And if kids have had different experiences or different trauma, really to dig into that and process with them. Because in a group setting, you don't necessarily have the opportunity to do so. So I think having more individualized services so that you can really work on each specific patient's goals is an area, too, that would be great for our field to be able to head in.
Well, finally, what critical data? I mean, you brought some there, but just you're talking about data that supports the results of music therapy. What's some of that data where it shows that, you know, you can maybe it's saying, well, we can wean people off meds or we can give them an improved prognosis of quality of life. What's some more of that data that you use to support that?
Personally, on a day-to-day setting and the behavioral health aspect, I work a lot on even just little aspects of the social skills like eye contact or initiating conversation. And it's amazing. I'll be working with the patient and you'll watch and see how many times maybe they'll make eye contact or kind of determine whatever your particular goal might be. And it's amazing through kind of the course of their music therapy services how you'll go from maybe they might make eye contact with you twice in a group, and then towards the end you might count up to 20 times. Or I'll have a patient that won't initiate any conversation, and then by the end they'll have just all sorts of statements that they've initiated and they've said. So that's just, I guess, kind of a few different examples of the different sort of data we're looking for and the improvements that we see.
Right. So you, like you said, you're documenting, you know, you're not just there to entertain them, but you're documenting, well, these are quantifiable improvements.
Yep. And at each time that we see a kid, we also do a written how the patient did in that group and describe their affect and if there's anything particular note. So we do quantitative, and then we also followed up with more of a qualitative description of how they're doing too. So that way you get kind of both sides. You have some data showing what you're doing, but sometimes the data can only really say so much. So then we also go on the other side of things too and sort of describe our opinion of what happened in that group and how, if you know, what progress is being made on the patient's goals.
Well, this has been great. I really appreciate your time, Amber. Thanks so much for enlightening us with this topic.
Yeah, thank you.
Today on Music for Life, we've explored the health properties of music. We have seen scientific support for this, as well as historic examples of it. We have seen it referenced in literature, in fable. We also saw the power of music referenced as early as the biblical record, with the account of David playing for King Saul. And even a more recent example, in the soldier who played his trumpet in World War II, to the point it soothed and disarmed a German sniper. For dessert today, where we hear an example from the popular or folk tradition or lighter classical fare to end the program, let's hear another lullaby. This was written by a pop star who had top 40 hits spanning 3 decades, but has also been recognized as a classical composer. In 2001, he released an album of purely classical piano pieces that hit number 1 on the classical charts. His father, after all, was a German classical pianist, and this particular lullaby that we're going to end the show with demonstrates some of his classical sensitivity, though it is a pop song. This is Billy Joel, personally my favorite song of his, Lullaby, Goodnight My Angel, written for his daughter Alexa and released in 1993.
Good night, my angel, time to close your eyes and save these questions for another day. I think I know what you've been asking me. I think you know what I've been trying to say. I promised I would never leave you, and you should always know, wherever you may go, no matter where you are, I never will be far away. Good night, my angel, now it's time to sleep, and still so many things I want to say. Remember all the songs you sang for me when we went sailing on an emerald bay, and like a boat out on the ocean, I'm rocking you to sleep. The water's dark and deep. Inside this ancient heart, you'll always be a part of me. Good night, my angel, now it's time to dream, and dream how wonderful your life will be. Someday your child may cry, and if you sing this lullaby, then in your heart there will always be a part of me. Someday we'll all be gone, but lullabies go on and on. They never die, that's how you and I will be.
You have been listening to Music for Life. From the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus, I'm Ryan Malone. Thanks for joining me.